All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going to be tackling a pretty fundamental question, right? You know, how do you prove something is real? Like in the legal world, how do you actually show a judge and jury that this email or this text message, it's legit? You know, it's really what it claims to be and not some fake.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so much of our lives is online now. Think about it. Emails, texts, social media posts, all of it can end up as evidence in a case. But proving who actually created that digital stuff, well, that's a whole other challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, no kidding. And that's exactly what we're going to be diving into today. We've got a really interesting case from Pennsylvania. It's called In the Interest of FP. And this case really gets at the heart of this authentication problem. So the question we're trying to answer today is, how did the court, in this case, allow these threatening instant messages, like actual IMs, to be used as evidence? And they did it without that, like super direct proof. Like they didn't have the ISP records saying, yep, this message came from this specific computer.
Right, right. I mean, that's usually what you think of, right? Like some kind of smoking gun tech data.
Exactly, yeah. But this case shows us that, well, there are other ways to get there. And that's what makes it so fascinating for law students or anyone really who's interested in, you know, the intersection of law and technology. So let's get into it. What exactly happened in this In the Interest of FP case?
Well, the case revolved around a juvenile, FP, who was ultimately found responsible for aggravated assault against another young person, ZG, and the assault. Well, it all started because of a fight over a stolen DVD.
A stolen DVD.
Yep, a stolen DVD. And this is where the instant messages come in. The prosecution, they brought in these threatening IMs that were supposedly sent to ZG, and they were claiming that these messages were directly tied to FP and, of course, to the assault itself.
So these messages were like a key part of their case. Like they were trying to use them to show that FP was like the aggressor and that he intended to hurt ZG.
Exactly. The messages were painting a picture of intent, you know, of premeditation.
Gotcha. But of course, like we were saying, things get complicated in the digital world. So what was FP's side of the story? What was his defense against these messages?
Well, unsurprisingly, FP denied having anything to do with the messages. His legal team, they argued that the prosecution hadn't actually proven that FP was the one behind those IMs. You know, they said there wasn't enough evidence to show that he was the person using that particular screen name.
Right, because like anyone could create an online account, right? It's not like you need to show your ID to sign up for like an instant messenger back then.
Precisely. And that's the whole point, isn't it? Like, how do you link that digital identity to a real person in the courtroom? It's not always so straightforward.
Yeah, it's tricky. So were there any other events like before the assault that kind of played a role in the case? Anything else the court looked at?
Actually, yes. There was a school mediation session that took place before the assault happened. And they were trying to, you know, resolve this whole situation with the stolen DVD. And guess what? Those instant messages, they came up in that meeting, too.
Oh, wow. So they were already a point of contention.
Yep. And here's the kicker. During that mediation, FP, he didn't deny sending those messages.
Oh, interesting. So he had a chance to say, hey, those aren't for me.
Mm.
But he didn't.
Exactly. And that ended up being very important for the court later on. So given all this, what was the main legal conclusion the appeals court had to figure out?
Okay, so the big question was whether the trial court made the right call by allowing those instant messages as evidence, even though there wasn't like that direct proof tying FP to the screen name. They had to figure out if the trial court messed up, basically, in their decision about those messages.
Right, because the trial court has to follow the rules of evidence just like any other court.
Yeah. And in Pennsylvania, the rule that applies here is Pennsylvania Rule of Evidence 901. And basically what this rule says is that if you're trying to use a piece of evidence, you need to show the court enough proof that a jury could reasonably believe the evidence is what you say it is.
So you're saying it's not just about having like a digital signature or something super technical like that?
Right. The rule is more flexible than that. It allows for something called circumstantial evidence.
Circumstantial evidence?
Yeah. Basically, it means you can look at all the details surrounding the evidence, the content, the timing, other events that were happening. And from those details, you can build a case for whether the evidence is authentic, even without that smoking gun proof.
Oh, okay, I see. Like if you get a letter talking about a super specific meeting you had, even if it's not signed, you might still be pretty sure who it's from based on the content, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like putting together a puzzle. You look at all the pieces and see if they fit together to create a clear picture.
Makes sense. So how did the court apply all this to the instant messages in the FP case? What did they decide?
Well, the appeals court ended up agreeing with the trial court. They said that, yeah, the instant messages were properly authenticated, even without that super direct proof. And they made this decision based on, like, a bunch of circumstantial evidence that all pointed to FP as the sender.
Okay, so they didn't just throw out the messages because they lacked that direct link. So what were the pieces of this circumstantial puzzle that convinced them?
All right, so first, those messages, they actually used FP's first name. Not the screen name, but like his actual name. Second, the content of the messages. It matched up perfectly with what other witnesses were saying about the whole stolen DVD thing, like all the details lined up. And third, get this, the messages actually talked about specific stuff that only came up during that school mediation, like details someone outside that meeting wouldn't know.
Wow, so it sounds like those messages had a lot of specific details tying them to FP in this whole situation. That's pretty strong circumstantial evidence, isn't it?
Right, and on top of all that, remember how FP didn't deny sending the messages during that school mediation? Well, the court thought that was super important too. They basically said, look, if these messages weren't from him, that was his chance to say so. And he didn't. So to them, that silence spoke volumes.
Yeah, I can see how the court would interpret that as, well, maybe he didn't deny it because they actually were his messages. So what about the argument that, you know, online stuff is easy to fake? Did the defense bring that up?
Oh, yeah, they totally did. They argued that because it's so easy to make anonymous online accounts, the court should require a much higher standard of proof for authenticating digital evidence. Like, they basically wanted special rules for digital stuff.
A separate set of rules just for digital evidence. Interesting. Did the appeals court buy that argument?
Nope, they weren't convinced. They said that Rule 901, the one we talked about earlier, is already flexible enough to handle the challenges of digital evidence. They pointed out that even with, like, old-fashioned letters, you can have questions about who wrote it. But courts have always used content and context to figure that out. So their point was, hey, the basic principles of authentication, they apply whether we're talking about a handwritten note or an instant message.
So the court basically said, no need to reinvent the wheel here. Just apply the existing rules thoughtfully to this new type of evidence.
Exactly. They thought the existing rule was up to the task. So this case, this in the interest of FP case, it set a pretty clear precedent in Pennsylvania, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It showed that circumstantial evidence. It can be enough to authenticate those digital communications, like those IMs. There's a really good example of how the courts are adapting those long-standing legal ideas to our modern tech-filled world.
For sure. And it's interesting because, you know, there are other states out there that might be a bit more strict. They might want more direct proof when it comes to digital evidence, you know, like maybe tracing those messages to a specific IP address or linking them to a phone number that's definitely associated with the defendant.
Right. Different jurisdictions can have their own little quirks, their own preferences, even when it comes to something as fundamental as evidence.
Yeah, for sure. So let's bring it back to our listeners, especially those future lawyers out there. What are the big takeaways from this case? What should they keep in mind when dealing with electronic evidence?
Okay, well, first off, if you're looking at digital messages, emails, whatever, really scrutinize the content itself. Is there anything in there that could point to the sender? Names, inside jokes, specific events they mention, that kind of stuff can be gold.
Yeah, like those specific details about the mediation in this case. Right. Those were huge.
Exactly. And always think about the timing. When was the message sent? What else was happening around that time? Does it all line up with other evidence you have?
Context is key.
Absolutely. And don't forget about witnesses. What can they tell you about the messages? Did they see them being sent? Did they talk to the sender about them? Those witness accounts can add a lot of weight to your case.
Yeah, it's all about building that bigger picture.
Yeah. And it's important to remember that judges, they have a lot of discretion.
Yeah, it makes sense. They're looking for fairness, but they're also respecting the judgment of that trial judge who's like right there in the courtroom hearing everything firsthand.
Right. Now, thinking about this case, you know, it makes me wonder, what if that screen name, ICP4Life30, what if it was just something totally random, like no connection to FP at all? Do you think all that other evidence, the stuff about the DVD, the mediation, that have been enough on its own?
Ooh, good question. It's hard to say for sure, right?
Yeah.
The court really leaned on that combo of the suggestive screen name, the content that matched the events, and that crucial lack of denial from FP. Take away the screen name, and it definitely gets murkier.
Right. It really shows how each case is unique. The court has to weigh all those factors together, the whole picture, to make a call. There's not always going to be a simple answer.
For sure. And I think that's a really important takeaway for everyone listening. When you're dealing with digital evidence, it's rarely going to be like, boom, here's the irrefutable proof. It's more like piecing together a puzzle.
Yeah.
You need to gather all those bits of information, all those circumstantial clues, and show how they all connect to point to the sender.
Exactly. And as technology keeps evolving, I mean, think about encryption, disappearing messages, all that stuff. Well, figuring out who's behind those communications, it's only going to get more complex.
Yeah, it's a constantly evolving challenge. So to wrap things up, the big lesson here is this. When you're trying to authenticate digital evidence, don't just fixate on finding that digital equivalent of a signature. Look at the content, look at the context, and use those to build your case.
And remember, future lawyers always, always check the specific rules of evidence in your jurisdiction. Those rules, they're your roadmap. They can make or break your case.
Seem to said it better myself. So before we go, here's something to chew on. We're living in a world that's increasingly digital, right? And as that happens, how do our legal systems keep up? How do we balance the need to hold people accountable with protecting everyone's rights in this new digital landscape?
It's a question we'll all be grappling with for a long time to come. And the answers, well, they're going to shape the future of law and technology.
Absolutely. All right, that's it for our deep dive today. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
See you then.